Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest edition, latest chapter, the latest great adventure from life on Planet Porky, with, of course, myself, the Porkmeister, and the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie-Ann Jones. Leslie-Ann, before we start relating our latest adventures, I just want to say a big thanks to everybody who tunes in every week. We've got a growing number of listeners and tremendous feedback, and it's nice to know that people appreciate the tales that we tell them.
It really is, and I just love the contact that we get from listeners. So many great tweets and texts and so on. It really feels like we have a relationship with our growing flock now, doesn't it, Mike?
We do. We do indeed. You're absolutely right. And the flock, of course, the most important issue when we get round to doing these podcasts. Now, I was very lucky this week. I worked with a real rock star, true living rock star. You've met plenty of rock stars in your life, Leslie-Ann. You know some of them as friends, and you've been reporting on others for 30 years or whatever. But I met James McVeigh on one day this week when I was working on television. Jeremy Vine on Five, actually. And although I've worked with James before, it was during lockdown. And so we were on two monitors, not physically there. But I met him for the first time this week. And what a lovely boy he is. And I mean that sincerely. The other thing about him is he's just got married. So, you know, a rock star just got married. You think, golly, what about rock and roll? But you couldn't find somebody who's less rock and roll than James McVeigh. Thoroughly nice guy, thoroughly bright and intelligent, talking about, you know, what marriage means to him and all that kind of stuff. And I had to sort of get into the debate by admitting, well, you know, I nearly got married four times. I was kind of engaged four times, but never got married. And I was just reflecting, you know, who's the most, who's the more responsible and the most together of the two of us? Me, a kind of wayward hack, journo, broadcaster, whatever you want to call me, or James McVeigh, the rock star?
Well, obviously, you come from two different age groups, if I may point that out. Yeah. So he's young and hopeful. He's found who he believes to be the one. You sort of a bit further down the line. You've had various relationships with women over the years. In fact, you had a lot in Fleet Street days, as I remember myself. But I didn't know you were engaged four times, by the way. That's very ambitious.
No, it was always by accident, you know. It was.
You had talked into it when you'd had a few.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I was actually. Yeah. On one occasion, I remember actually being in a Chinese restaurant on the Wandsworth Road, I think it was, or somewhere around there, you know, somewhere in East London. And you know,
Wandsworth Road is actually in Southwest London.
That's right. Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah. Southwest London. That's right. Yeah. Is it like from the Elephant and Castle downward, so to speak?
Wandsworth is about there and it stretches right the way over to Putney, doesn't it?
Yeah. And the lady I was going out with at the time lived in an horrendous block of council flats there. Okay. I mean, really horrendous. She'd got divorced. Okay. And, you know, the marital home had busted up. There was no money left because they were young and hadn't put much of a deposit down. And she ended up, but fortunately, her dad knew somebody on the council who managed to get her a council flat, right? And but it was
She saw you coming, Porky, swinging your wallet.
Well, I wasn't swinging my wallet, but I mean,
swinging something else.
No, Miss Jones, family show, family please. Let's not get into that. But she was very attractive, and she worked in Fleet Street. That's how I got to know her. She was sitting in the pub after work and that kind of stuff. And she lived in this hideous council flat where there were bars on the windows, you know, and metal gates across the door.
Or to stop you getting out or to stop people getting in.
Well, I think to stop me getting out, I think. But, you know, regularly you'd see people running up and down the walkways carrying televisions that they just nicked, you know what I mean? All this kind of stuff. It was horrendous. So I remember it was exactly as you just said, a late night Chinese after, you know, a few drinks in Fleet Street, jump into a cab, come on, let's go down the Wandsworth Road, the Chinese, favourite Chinese. And at midnight that night, I was coerced somehow into making a proposal. And the first thing she did when we got back to this flat of hers was pick up the phone and ring her sister and tell her sister she was getting married. And that's when it sort of hit home to me. You know, I thought, hang on, she's taking this a bit too seriously. Anyway, the relationship.
Well, how are you supposed to not take a proposal seriously, I suppose?
Well, yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. But I mean, look, I did some research about this, yes. You know, about single, never married men, such yes. as your good self. Mm. And I was surprised to learn that men like you, Mike, lead very healthy, fulfilling lives. And actually, there is strength in solitude. Mm. You have a deeper connection to your work and to your friends, your parents, other family members.
Yep.
And you also continue to grow as people. Yeah. Whereas married fathers tend to get sucked into that whole, yeah. got to provide, got to bring home the bacon, got to bring up the kids. It's all stress for years and years and years. Mm. And then the kids are suddenly grown up and they leave home and you flop in your chair and think, what was all that about?
Yeah. I think there's something in that. I don't have any regrets about not getting married. I read a piece once by some journo, you know, somebody who's probably been a colleague of ours along the way in Fleet Street, who'd never got married either. And he said he met an old pal after 20 years. You know, they worked on a local paper together somewhere in England, and then 20 years later... And when he went round to his house, he said he introduced me to his four sons, aged between 12 and 16. And the pangs of regret shot through me, what it could have been, what I could have had. You know, I could have been the father of a family. And but that's never occurred to me. I've never had the turn. I didn't get on very well with my old fella, actually. I didn't get on very well with my
dad. Did you not? Oh, well, that probably had a huge amount to do with it.
It probably did. I never felt comfortable at home when my father was around. You know, he was a very, deep and brooding sort of a man. And it may well be that I thought, well, if this is domesticity, you can forget it. You know, I don't really want it or something like that. I don't know.
You loved your mum, though.
Oh, of course I did. Loved my mum to bits, you know. And, yeah. You know, till
I'm sorry.
Died. Yeah, but...
I got married once. I did kind of marry quite late in life, yeah. actually. I'd been a single mother for 8 years when I met the man I married.
Amazing.
And the marriage lasted for 11 years.
Yeah.
Fell apart for all kinds of reasons, mm-hmm. which best not go into here. But
yes.
Do I regret it? I cannot say that I do, because I wouldn't have my beautiful younger children, Henry and Bridie,
exactly.
had I not married him. They're yep. obviously half him mm. and half me. Mm. So I can't say that I regret it altogether. But I tell you one thing, I'll never speak to him again. Ever in my life.
Yeah, and of course, we've talked before, we don't want to go too deeply into it, your personal life, but your actual circumstances, you know, the way you had to battle on through life after divorce and all that, I have nothing but admiration for you. But it was a hell of a strain, wasn't it, when you were a working journalist yeah. trying to travel the world?
Yeah, it was. But no regrets on that front either, because I'm yeah. doing work today that I really love, and all the things that we did in the past all stack up to who we are today.
Yeah, no.
So no regrets, and that's the important thing.
I think you're right. Talking about your work, Ms. Jones, you've been quite busy this week, and at the centre of it all has been your old pal, now deceased, obviously, but a legend of the rock business, Freddie Mercury. You've made not just one, but two programmes about him. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, Freddie's, can you believe this, 30th anniversary.
Yeah.
So 30 years since he died
yeah.
On the 24th next week. And I made quite a few Freddie documentaries during the lockdowns, actually, because television production companies got into this whole thing of, oh, we don't need a studio anymore. We don't right. need to book a venue. We can send a box of kit round to the person's house, the contributor's house, in this case me, and they can set it all up. We don't need a producer. We don't need a sound guy, a lighting guy, anyone there on site. So they're saving all this money. They're still doing it, some of them as well, which makes me a bit cross, because
yes.
there's no excuse now.
No.
But anyway, one of the TV documentaries I made, Freddie Mercury in His Own Words, will be airing this coming Sunday night on Channel 5 at 9 o'clock.
Very good.
I also did a documentary for BBC Radio 4 Archive on 4 with Satnam Sangara from The Times. And that is going out on BBC Radio 4 at 8 o'clock on Saturday night. So a big Freddie weekend for me, this one.
Well, big Freddie weekend for any Freddie Mercury fans. And there are millions of them out there, are there not?
Yes.
Yeah, indeed. Talking about not necessarily rock stars, but singing stars and all that. I saw Tony Christie on the telly this week, OK? I think he's actually got a new tour out. I think he's about 80, isn't he? Or 82 or something like that.
He's well into his dotage, isn't he, really?
Yeah.
I can't think of another example of an artist, let's use the term loosely, who has made such a massive career out of being a one-hit wonder, really, hasn't he?
Yeah, but this was the story. It was a fantastic story. So he was, you know, struggling for records and all that kind of stuff, and went over to America. He met Neil Sedaka. And he met Neil Sedaka at Neil Sedaka's studios. We all know who Neil Sedaka is, you know. What's his famous song?
Walking in the Rain with the One I Love. It's the one that always springs to mind.
The One I Love.
Oh, and Carol, which he wrote about. Carol King, right. Of course, yeah.
Yeah, I remember one as well of his, and it was Standing on the Inside, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, or whatever. Anyway, that's all I can remember.
Well, his career, interestingly, was killed off by the Beatles, Neil Sedaka.
Was it?
Because
Why?
He was making all that old-fashioned, lovey-dovey 1950s Doris Day-type music. And then along come these invaders from Britain.
That's right.
With this knock-your-socks-off pop. And Neil Sedaka's career was wrecked by that. He did make a comeback in the 70s, but he was thrown over the side.
Yeah.
But he did write Amarillo, or co-wrote it, I should say, with a guy called Howard Greenfield.
This is the great story. So old Tony Christie goes into Neil Sedaka's studios, and Neil's actually in the studio, you know, recording something. And his agent says, look, we've got a song we've kind of half made, which we're not really bothered about, which we could give to you if you want it. He said, let me hear it. So it went, you know, is this the way to Amarillo? Da, 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 da. And then the middle bit was sha la 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 boom. La 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 boom. That's right. And the manager,
or something like that.
It was, honestly. And the manager said, you see, that's all we've done. We've got no words for the middle bit. And Tony Christie said, what do you mean no words? You've got sha-la-la-la-la. Yeah, that's just somebody singing sha-la-la. We can't think of any words to put in there. He said, no, don't leave it like that.
Because they're very easy to remember. So the simpler a song and the more the public can remember the song, the bigger a hit it's going to be.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. And I think they must have thought that. But I can see that you don't have necessarily a huge professional respect for Mr. Christie, but... You know,
it's not a bad song. I tell you what, it wasn't a huge hit here when it first came out, 72, I think it was. It was a massive hit across Europe, which tells you everything you need to know about European tastes in pop music, which is why Eurovision is such a disaster. But it was a moderate hit in the UK.
Yeah.
It became very big here on its reissue in the 2000s. But the song, interestingly, being an American song, it never happened in the US.
Yeah.
It's got quite a country and western feel to it.
Yes.
So you'd think it would be popular there, but it wasn't. Neil Sedaka later recorded it himself, and it wasn't a hit for him either. It missed out on the top 40.
Golly.
So it sort of slipped away. Do you know what Amarillo means?
Well, it's an animal and it's a town, isn't it?
An animal. No, it's actually Spanish for yellow, amarillo.
Oh.
And this is the name of a place in Texas.
Oh, so
the song is about a guy who's going back to Amarillo in Texas to find his girlfriend, Marie. Very simple song, very country western theme.
Yeah.
But, you know, in those days, we were not into country and western in this country.
I'm not into country and western ever. I can't understand why people say, oh, the Eagles, country and western group. What? I don't think so. Is there a difference between country and western and sort of country rock or something?
Well, there are many nuances to these musical genres now, but we have to remember that all music is founded in the black music of slaves in the Deep South in America and also from the hillbillies in the mountains.
Hillbillies,
and those two things converged and are the foundations of rock and roll, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you're absolutely right. The hillbillies. I used to love that show, the Beverly
Beverly Hillbillies. Yeah. Wasn't that great? Fantastic. I loved it too. You wouldn't get away with it now because it would be cultural appropriation, wouldn't it?
Oh, you bet. Yeah, it was the big daft guy, Jethro, wasn't it? Yeah, Jethro. But
I can't remember. They had that little song at the beginning. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that's right. I know the words to it. Now, let me tell you now a story about a man called Jed, a poor man in here just to keep his family fed. And then one day he was shooting for some, and out from the ground came a bubbling. Oh, that's right. And then one day he was out hunting food when out from the ground came a bubbling crude oil.
Oil, that is.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well done. So there we are. And you're right about the European records, by the way, with no disrespect to people like Sam Fox, you know, a former Page Three model, beautiful girl who became a singer. They hits only ever seem to sort of get up the charts in Japan and Europe. You're absolutely right.
If you had a hit in Europe but not in the UK, you kind of knew that you were sliding, really.
Yeah, that's right. You're right about Tadaka as well. He must have been finished off, wiped off the face of the earth that day. The Billboard chart showed the Beatles in the top five positions in the chart. But anyway, there
His
we are.
His heart must have sunk.
It must have sunk indeed. I read a piece about, this is interesting because it's in our business. I try to watch as much television as I can for the news programmes to keep up with things. And one of the duets that work in BBC News is Naga Manchetti and a guy called Charlie State, okay? And they work out of Salford, you know, where the BBC News programmes come from. And I was amazed to see a piece in the paper saying there's a lot of tension there behind the scenes, that she sort of, you know, is a bit harsh with him and he's a bit sort of dismissive of her and that kind of stuff. I mean, I don't know if you've had it in the past, Leslie-Ann, but when you're falling out with somebody, you've got to work cheek by jowl with, which is almost literally the way you have to work in a double presenting show. It's very, very hard.
Yeah, it is. I actually hate this kind of thing, and it has crossed my mind. Are they doing this to try and win more viewers?
Well, yeah,
to sort of
yeah.
boost the show, you know, a bit of creative tension
yes.
and all that.
Yes.
I can remember working on the Daily Mail. I had a very nice colleague I used to sit next to called Anne Barraclough. She's back in Australia now. But,
oh, yeah.
They sat us next to each other to try and make this creative tension. They used to send us out on the same jobs every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were always kind of competing with each other to try and get the piece in the paper.
Yeah.
The Daily Mail was notorious for commissioning 15 to 1. And there was a lot of this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Horribly unprofessional. Mm. But of course, what they hadn't bargained for was that we actually became mates.
Mm.
And so we were working together in the end to try and get the best story across, which is the whole point of a newspaper. But I do think that bringing personal feuds into the workplace is a very unprofessional thing.
Yeah.
If you fall out with a colleague, it's unfortunate, but the professional way forward is to find a way around it.
Mm.
And that's what you have to do. You've got no choice. You've got to see them every day.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. When I started in radio, I was working with Alan Brazil, and we did 5 years together on The Breakfast Show, 6 days a week, starting at 6 and finishing at 10, you know, including Saturday. And it was a dreamlike relationship. Then I was struck down with acute heart failure, and I was 7 months out, most of it in hospital. And when I came back, the slot had gone. Life just moves on, I'm afraid. And
it does,
time waits for nobody, you know what I mean? And even though I, you know, made a plea that, you know, I could rebuild it with Alnett, somebody else had stepped in there and they didn't want to change back, all that kind of stuff. That's just life. But then I ended up working with a guy called Paul Breen Turner. Now, Paul was a really nice guy, and he had an interesting history. He was a self-taught journalist who ended up in Spain, started one of these sort of people's radio stations, you know what I mean, which you broadcast from your kitchen and all that kind of stuff, and then became a correspondent for the work we did there, and then used to make regular visits to Britain and would appear on the shows and all that. And I thought he had a good enough personality to accompany him on an afternoon show, okay? But I'm afraid it was a disaster. It just didn't work out. We simply did not get on air. And the warmth and the camaraderie and the, you know, sort of gentle mockery, you know, between each other that I enjoyed with Alan Brazil never happened there. He couldn't get it. I couldn't take it from him. And it blew up after about 3 weeks. And I'm afraid it fractured the friendship we'd had for many years afterwards.
Have you spoken to him since?
Not much. He went back to Spain, and interesting character. He now lives on a boat in the harbour in Marbella and all that kind of stuff, you know. But I see him occasionally when I've been over in Spain and all that. But it was just unfortunate. And what I was going to say is that it's very painful working. I mean, you said you got on with your friend Anne Barraclough, okay? But we didn't get on. And it's very, very painful trying to make it work when it clearly isn't. And then you've got the afters. You've got to remember, a show lasts 3 hours. So you've got a build-up of about 2 hours when you're trying to you know, impress your view on the show, and he's trying to impress his. And then after the show, you would normally go for a drink, but, you know, it's getting all hard and bitter, and you might go for a drink, then have a few drinks, and then blow up and all that kind of stuff. It's a constant headache. And I advise anybody who's in that position just to, you know, life's too short to have to go through that pain, and just think about it and maybe do something else, you know?
Well, it really is, actually. But when you're working in a newsroom with other journalists, you know, what choice do you have? You can leave the job. Are you going to get another job very easily? Especially not these days.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, I agree.
I'm in favour of trying to find ways around it. But you're right. When a broadcast, a programme depends on chemistry between two presenters,
it does.
That's a whole different thing. Yeah. And either the chemistry is there or it's not.
Yeah.
And I think in the case of Naget and Charlie, Charlie's a really nice guy, by the way.
Yes.
I'm not saying that she's not a nice girl because I haven't met her, but I have worked with him. I went up to Salford and did their programme one Saturday morning.
Oh, well done. Yeah.
What a nice man he is. You know, really genuinely caring and helpful. They're going to have to work it out.
Yeah, well, indeed. But anyway, there we are. Now, Miss Jones, tell me this. You are a woman renowned for your fashion sense, and, you know, you have been La Belle de Fleet Street for many, many years. But would you see this story? I can't believe it. M&S Attire for Hire, a store launches eco-friendly clothing rental service. Would you pay £13 to borrow, that is rent, a £69 dress for 4 days? I wouldn't go around hiring. I don't even hire suits when I go to weddings and things. I always go and buy one.
I think it's a very strange thing because this is not couture. I can understand in certain circumstances women renting £7,000-£8,000 ball gowns for a one-off thing. You
know? Yes, sure.
And quite a lot of women do rent their wedding dresses. I didn't. I bought mine, but yeah, it was a huge amount of money. It got stuffed in a cupboard. Somebody stood in one of the loops and ripped it, so it was ruined on the day anyway.
Surely.
So it is a big waste of money when you think about it. But 13 quid for a top. Yeah. Aren't you just going to go and buy it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you could buy it for half that price, couldn't you, in Primark, if it was just for a one-off use?
Yeah, but we boycott Primark, don't we, because of all the child labour scandals throughout the world. Yes.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. But we cannot justify this disposable fashion scandal that the world is facing now, because we've got millions of discarded garments washing up on the shores of Nigeria and so on that have all just been thrown in the sea. Disposable fashion is not the way forward. We should be buying way fewer clothes, keeping them for much longer, because we've invested in better things.
I totally agree with all that. I mean, I can't imagine a woman renting her bridal dress, to be honest. The thought that it's not unique to her on the most important day of her life, that just make, you know, if I was getting married, and we've talked about marriage already in this podcast, I wouldn't want my bride to turn up in a rented dress that somebody else had worn at another ceremony. That would destroy me. In fact, I'd ban it. I'd have to.
There is symbolism attached to wedding clothes, isn't there?
Yeah.
There's a great story about Keith Richards and Mick Jagger in Amsterdam in the 1980s. And they'd been out, I think it's quite a famous story, they'd been out on the town, they came back wrecked.
Yeah.
Mick was up for a party, so he called to Charlie Watts's room, and Charlie picked up the phone. He said, "Where's my drummer?" And Charlie didn't say anything. He just put down the phone. 20 minutes later, there was a knock at the door of Keith Richards' suite. And he opened the door. In comes Charlie in full Savile Row suit. He'd had a shower. He'd shaved. He was reeking of aftershave. Yeah. He was suited and booted. He said nothing. He walked across the room and punched Mick in the face.
Really?
Mick fell backwards into a plate of smoked salmon towards an open window.
Yeah.
And Keith Richards said, and below the open window was a canal. If Mick had gone out of the window and fallen all that way down into the canal, he would have been killed. And Charlie said later, "What stopped you?" In other words, why didn't you let him fall out the window?
Yeah.
And Keith said he was wearing my wedding jacket. I'd lent it to him. So he'd suddenly realised at that point, oh, my God, my wedding jacket's about to go into a canal in Amsterdam. Yeah. So he grabbed Mick by the lapels
and saved him.
by default saved his life, but he was really saving the wedding jacket, which meant so much to him.
Yeah, excellent. Good. Well, you know, that's how I like my rock groups to behave. You know, that's why Liam Gallagher is one of my favourites, because I think he was the last one I remember who threw a television out of the window of a hotel bedroom.
Ah, but he wasn't the first to do
Well, he wasn't the first, obviously, but there we are. I've got a story about that, actually. During the Toxteth riots, I did all the riots at the start of the 80s. I did Brixton, Toxteth, Moss Side in Manchester, Leeds. I don't know why. I kept sending me to where all the riots were.
You were the riot whisperer.
I was the riot whisperer, yeah. And, you know, standing there dodging the petrol bombs and all that kind of stuff. But I remember at Toxteth, excuse me, what always accompanies a riot is looting. And, you know, this family had taken advantage of the riot, gone into a TV shop and stolen four televisions. And they put them in the bedroom of the house. Police turned up to find out where they were. And the police turned up, knocked on the front door. The family ordered their son to rush upstairs and throw the televisions out of the bedroom window into the back garden. Except that the police had come up the back garden as well, because they anticipated them fleeing out of the house. And a policeman was very badly hurt by a falling television, which hit him on the head. So I'm afraid, you know, that's just the story of a riot. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, Portmeister, and, of course, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, we've talked already about, you know, your life as a mother of three and all that. What do you think about this kids' obesity clinics? You know, lockdown has triggered record levels of childhood obesity, number of kids starting school fat rocketing by 45%, and now the government are thinking of introducing obesity clinics and ordering parents to take their children there.
I mean, it's a good idea, isn't it? I think a lot of kids have been very poorly fed. We know why. There isn't enough money around. Lots of families do resort to fast food, McDonald's and all that kind of stuff on a daily basis in some cases. Yeah. A lot of families can't be bothered to cook, don't know how to cook, haven't got the money to buy proper ingredients.
Yeah.
It's all a knock-on effect, isn't it? And these poor kids are suffering.
Yeah.
Yes, they should be forced to address the problem. And obesity clinics are probably a good idea, because you're not going to get in to see a GP right now.
No, I always prefer to say, you know, it's parental responsibility, and if they parents feed their children properly, they don't get obese anyway. But I don't suppose it's quite
not
as simple as
that. Not all parents are that discerning or caring.
Yeah. No, I know you're probably right. What do we make of Adele then and opera? And what do we make of opera and her reputation now? Because she gave the softest platform in the world to Harry and Meghan. Half of what they told her has turned out to be either inaccurate or untrue. And now you've got Adele swanning up to the court of Queen Opera. You know, does this finally mean that Adele has reached, you know, the heights of utter fame worldwide because she's been on the couch with Opera?
Do you know, Oprah Winfrey needs to be very careful here, because she is being played.
Mm.
I feel very strongly about the Harry Meghan interview.
Yep.
They clearly lied to her. They clearly fed a lot of untruths and used her as a platform, a global platform, to get their message out.
They did.
I loved Piers Morgan's tweet the other day, which said, you know, I didn't believe Meghan when she said X, Y, Z to Oprah, full stop. Mm. I still don't.
Mm.
And I thought, good for you, because a lot of people blasted Piers Morgan for his views on Meghan at the time.
Yeah.
And everything he said about her originally is turning out to be true.
Yeah, I think.
But I think Oprah's credibility is diminishing.
Yeah, I
because
agree.
She's being used as this sort of soft interviewer, a very mild mouthpiece to get views across which are questionable. And I think in the case of Adele, it's all a bit me, me, me. She said for years how much she hated her father. She wanted nothing to do with him because he abandoned her and her mother and left them to fend for themselves. And then, of course, over the years, he tried many times to make contact. She didn't have anything to do with him still. And she just brushed him off every time. Then he turns out to be afflicted with cancer. And so they have this great deathbed reconciliation scene, which I think is obscene.
Yeah.
And then she goes on Oprah and cries all about this. And forgetting the fact that she'd been very harsh and uncaring towards her father all those years. So I do think people are using her to sanitize their reputations. And I think she wants to be very careful about that.
Yeah, no, I think that's, they're very wise words indeed. But the problem is, when you're Oprah Winfrey and nobody says boo to a goose to her, do they? You know, nobody says no to Oprah. Nobody says, oh, I don't think that's right. She's now unable to calculate, you know, the amount of good or bad she's doing. I think she's lost touch with reality, because I think she's sort of out of reality. On the Piers thing, you're absolutely right. I think Piers took a picture of four front pages, each one of which questioned the honesty of Meghan and Harry after Meghan suddenly revealed she could remember helping to influence the book that was written about her. And as you quite rightly pointed out, Piers said, hang on, I've told you all this. And he said at the time, one of the reasons he left was making the statement, I wouldn't believe Meghan if she read the weather report, okay?
And, I love that.
Yeah, yeah. And you're so right. And now she's just blithely turned around and said, oh, I think, yes, I've just remembered, I found an email in which I instructed my press secretary to cooperate with the people who wrote the book, which makes me look like a great person. I mean, it's outrageous, isn't it?
I'm sorry, but this is no defence. And in a court of law, she would be lambasted for that, if not worse.
Yeah.
Because you can't, we can all go into a courtroom now and say, sorry, I forgot.
Yes,
it's right. That, to me, is no defence. Yes. You either did it or you didn't.
Yeah.
And you're not going to forget something like that anyway. No, sorry, no. It doesn't wash.
I totally agree. I forgot something this week, actually. I got lambasted for. I was talking about the Scottish football team, OK? And I was actually praising Steve Clarke, who's the manager. He used to be at Chelsea and West Brom, I think. And I actually said, you know, I admire the Scots. They got through to the playoffs now for next year's World Cup, and they've done it on a very small squad of players. You know, for instance, they can't even call on players these days from the English Premier League. And it went on past until, you know, somebody picked it out in a sort of 5-second clip. And put it out and said, you're an idiot. And I found out then they have got players from the English Premier League. So I got a bit lambasted for that. The penalty is I'm going to have to appear on the same show in a kilt on St. Andrew's Day, which is November the 30th.
And you know what I'm going to ask?
Oh, no, no. I'm sorry, Miss Jones. I don't reveal secrets like that. No way in the world, you know. I will not even tell you on the day. But anyway,
Tesco's or Armani.
Yeah, absolutely. See, it's a bit harsh, isn't it? You know, I'm the butt of a lot of your jokes, aren't I, Miss Jones? Anyway, listen, we can't...
You sound like Mr. Rigsby.
Yeah, well, I'm a bit. We can't go through a podcast, of course, without referring to our favourite subject. Well, certainly my favourite subject, and one that you know a lot more about than I do, but the Beatles thing's coming to a crescendo. I think it was only last night, as we are recording, that the official unveiling of Let It Be, the documentary, took place at in Leicester Square with the man, is it Peter Jackson, the guy who made it?
Indeed, and Paul McCartney himself and his daughter Mary. And so this morning everybody's asking the question, where was his wife, Nancy?
Yes. Oh, that's... does she come with him when he comes to Britain, or does she live permanently in America?
She's quite often on his arm at different events.
Oh,
and it's unusual not to see her, actually. So
are you saying here, Miss Jones?
I hope she's not unwell. Mm. I hope she's not unwell, all. But, you know, why shouldn't he go to one of these things with one of his daughters if he wants to? Yeah, it begs a few questions, doesn't it?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way. I'd only thought of the enduring appeal of the Beatles. I mean, I know I'm a Beatles bore. I know that. And whenever I get into a pub...
It's impossible to be a Beatles bore.
Well, that's what I think. But then I'm the generation. I didn't grow up as a teenager with the Beatles. I grew up as a kid. So I was 10 years younger than George Harrison, okay? So I was a kid in the 60s. I took my 11 plus in 1966 when the Beatles were at their height. But then I grew up with the rest of the Beatles up until they split up in 1970, if you see what I mean. So I'm obsessed with the Beatles. And funnily enough, the only records I've ever retained are all the Beatles records. And I've got a set in mono and I've got a set in stereo, believe it or not. You know, complete sets and all that kind of stuff. But the reason I'm saying this is because I was quite comforted last weekend when all the heavy, important, you know, papers, the worthy ones, the broadsheets, Telegraph, Times, all ran supplements about the Beatles because of the release of this new documentary, Let It Be. And I thought, well, hang on, it's not just me then who's obsessed. The whole generation of mine must be obsessed to carry pictures on the front of the feature sections, special glossy pullouts. I mean, it's not just me, is it?
No, but, you know, newspapers, it's a bit too easy, isn't it, to fill up your column inches and your pages with pictures.
But it's fascinating. I mean, every time I read a new account of somebody who worked on the Let It Be album, you know, in 69 or whenever it was, and the falling apart of the Beatles, I still find it utterly fascinating.
Yeah, of course it is, because we weren't there.
Yeah.
And so we're picking up all of this stuff secondhand. I, similar to you, I discovered Wings first.
Yeah.
That they were my first great love. So Paul McCartney's group after the Beatles.
Sure.
And then I discovered the Beatles backwards. And it's very interesting that people always focus on Paul McCartney's Beatle years, because
yes,
he had a 50-year career after the Beatles, if you know what I mean.
Yes, he did, yeah.
There were the Wings years. There were the solo career years. Mm. They've wiped out so much music by focusing on the Beatles all the time.
Yeah.
And that must rankle with him, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think you're right. The strangest line I've read, because there's been so much written about it over this week, because that let it be, is Paul McCartney talking about death and mortality. I found it very strange. Macca says, "I sing so I can let death be." So Paul McCartney has revealed he keeps singing and performing to avoid thinking about death. He goes on to say, "If I didn't have a new project or challenging to conquer, I can only imagine I'd start thinking further or deeper about the reality of death. And that's not something I want to do particularly." I think that's quite brave. He says, "Death doesn't scare me. When you get to my age, you have to accept your mortality." But that's a very rational way of thinking about, you know, one day your life's going to end, isn't it?
Well, first of all, he's very fortunate to have the kind of work that he doesn't have to retire from.
Yes, yeah, sure.
Because he works for himself, basically. He doesn't need to work. He's worth millions upon millions. He works at something he loves, and therefore that keeps him going. It keeps him young.
Yeah.
When anyone reaches their mid to late 70s, death becomes a preoccupation. It could happen any day. Mm. It's more likely to happen at that stage in your life than it is at ours, for example. Touch
yeah, I
wood,
suppose so. Yeah.
If there's any around.
Yeah.
But it does become something. I remember my father in his final years was more or less every time I saw him, he talked about death and how worried he was about it.
Yeah.
Because he'd had to retire at 74, which was actually quite late
for
someone like him. But
yeah,
he didn't want to stop, so he kept going as long as he could.
Mm.
The minute my father stopped working, he started to diminish.
Yes.
Because he'd lost his status, the thing that identified him, which was his work, his job. And Macca knows that. He instinctively knows that if he stopped doing what he does, he would begin to diminish.
Yeah.
So this displacement and deferment, it does work. It's a form of denial.
Yeah.
But what else are you going to do? You know, the Stones are doing it too, by the way. You look, they're out on the roads and playing every other night across the States, and they'll be here next year. And as long as they can keep going and they hang on to their marbles, that's the crucial bit, isn't it? You've got to hang on to your marbles, otherwise you can't do what Paul McCartney's doing.
That's right. We'll talk about the marbles in a minute, the Elgin marbles. But
I was giving you that link there.
I know you were, and I'm coming back to it. Thank you very much indeed. We will segue into that in a second. But you're so right. My mum was 72 when she was finally told she had to leave Debenhams. Now, Debenhams, where she used to work in Bournemouth, now closed down. Debenhams is gone, right? And I think the whole sort of high store, high street is under threat, obviously. But she was supposed to retire when she was 65. And they kept her on until she was 72. She was a very good worker, very honest, you know, very good timekeeper and very polite to all the customers and all that. But eventually, at 72, they said, you know, look, Joan, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm afraid we've got to make way for somebody else now. And she was absolutely heartbroken. And, you know, the first day she got up and there was no work to go to was the start of her decline. You're absolutely right. Her life then became a sort of miserable, not miserable in that sense, but she was challenged every day to try and find something to grab her interest. She lived alone. My father died many, many years before her. And like you've just said about your father, it was honestly the start of a very new life for her and not a very pleasant one.
I'm so sorry. You know that her purpose was taken away from her.
Yes, it was.
We all have to have something to get up in the morning for.
That's right.
And I know that I will never retire. And I'm very lucky to have the kind of work that I can do easily and from home, you know, in my home office and so on. I'm not somebody who's having to get on public transport every day and hack into an office in town. And so therefore, I am fortunate. Can continue for as long as I want, and I know that you can as well. But the vast majority of people haven't got that advantage, and I think we need to be a bit more mindful as a nation, as a world, in terms of how our elderly have fulfilling ends of lives.
I totally agree with you. All her life, you know, as we grow up through teenage and adults and all that, my mum used to say, I don't want anything off my children. Oh, you won't find me wanting anything off you when I get older. But she did. She wanted our time. And, you know, I feel very guilty about it now. How often did I go down to Bournemouth and see my mum? How often did I go and see her and spend time with her, take her out for lunch and all that kind of stuff, you know? That's all they do want is your time. And my younger sister, Jill, a wonderful woman who lives in Bournemouth, and that's why mum went and moved there, all the pressure was on Jill to be around and see my mum every couple of days or even every day, you know? And you do feel guilty about it in the end, you know? And I just to say to everybody out there listening, please appreciate your mum and dad while you've got them, because when they've gone, it's too late and you might be full of regret. But anyway, look, don't want
definitely. Oh no, I mean, I miss my father so much, and I did see a lot of him. I see my mum every Sunday. I speak to her every day. Mum's 86 now. And I know, I'm very aware, because my dad isn't here anymore, she's not going to be here much longer. So I have to make the most of her, and we have a much better relationship now than we did when I was young. It's worth pursuing, you know. It's even if you feel that all is lost, you don't want that sense of regret after they've gone.
I totally agree. But anyway, not to get too maudlin, let's return to the Elgin Marbles. I'm a big supporter of give back the Elgin Marbles to the excuse me.
Are you choking on your marbles, darling?
I'm choking on my marbles there. I think the Elgin Marbles should be returned. I can't see any reason at all that, or any validation to say, well, they belong in the British Museum in Britain. A guy called Lord Elgin stole them from the Parthenon Museum in Greece on top of the Acropolis, and they should be returned, shouldn't they?
No.
What?
He didn't steal them, and I don't know where you got that from. Lord Elgin paid the equivalent of, in today's money, almost £5 million to excavate and transport those marbles, took them to Malta first, and they eventually made their way here, where they've been looked after beautifully. And I have to say, Greece got that money, which was a huge amount of money. They were acquired legally under laws that were in place at that time. You've only got to go to Athens to see what a filthy place it is. Their prize city. They should look after it better. They're not going to look after the Elgin marbles if we give them back. But the fact is, they were bought. They were purchased privately, and they belong to the person who bought them, who then donated them to the nation here.
Oh, well, hang on.
And I think they should stay here.
No, hang on. I tried to read a bit on it. I haven't got as much detail as you. But didn't the British government then buy them off Elgin and put them in the British Museum? And therefore, that's why I say they were stolen, because it was almost like state-sponsored theft.
Well, no, if an item changes hands for money, it isn't stolen, is it?
Yeah, but it was a long time ago. It's still part of the culture of Greece. I understand what you're saying about Athens, by the way. I've been to Athens a few times. I've never really enjoyed it. And I'm not being disrespectful to the Greek people, but I don't like hot places and hot cities. And Athens has always been very, very hot when I've been there, you know, and made me feel sort of uncomfortable, really. But Greece has been through the most appalling, you know, financial collapse over the last 10 years. We'd have ended up like Greece, actually, if Mrs. Thatcher hadn't got into power in 79 and taken on the unions, because that's what happened in Greece. In Greece, you know, everybody was employed by the state or ruled by a union, and they just went bankrupt.
Can I say something else about the British Museum?
Yeah.
They've got a load of Egyptian artefacts in there as well, and from other countries all over Africa, and indeed from all around the world. If we give back the Elgin Marbles, we're going to have to give all of that stuff back as well.
Yeah, but at least,
and it would open the floodgates, and the British Museum would have nothing left.
But at least we went over there and excavated the artifacts. You know, we dug through the pyramids and all that. The Elgin Marbles were just there, and we just said,
"No, they weren't. No, they weren't." He excavated them. He paid for them to be excavated transported from Greece, from around the Parthenon.
Yeah. So were they excavated? I'm sorry, from an underground tomb or something?
I think so. Yeah. haven't read that deeply into it, but they were. He did. Money changed hands in order for him to excavate them from the ground and to transport them and protect them, which is what it was all about. Mm. Because otherwise those things would have turned to dust centuries ago and they wouldn't even exist today. So I think let's be fair to the British Museum. You know, they've done a very good job of preserving them.
Yes.
And that is the point. It doesn't mean to say they are not Greek. Mm. What are they going to do with them if we give them back?
Yeah.
Likely they will sell them to a private collector for loads of money to dig themselves out of this financial hole.
Well,
so I don't approve of them going back.
That is a very cynical view, Miss Jones. Talking about that part of the world, Greece, I said I've been to Athens a few times. One time I was in Athens because it was the only route into Libya and the Americans were about to bomb Libya. And I knew that because my friend in Washington, Ross Mark, who was the Daily Express correspondent in Washington and who I worked with in the 80s when I was in New York, he'd actually contacted me and told me that his intelligence from his friends in the military were that the Americans were going to strike against Gaddafi in the next 2 or 3 days. I was in, I think I've told you, I was in Pakistan at the time with Benazir Bhutto. When he contacted me, he rang the hotel I was in Pakistan, which wasn't an easy thing to do in those days, phone calls from America to Pakistan. But anyway, I spoke to the office and they said, you've got to get there as quickly as you can. And I got the last plane from Athens into Libya, into Tripoli, because the Libyans also thought they were going to get bombed. They had some intelligence on it and they closed all the airlines. And mine was the last flight in, literally the last flight in. And I was the only person on the plane. And the reason I'm telling you all this is because I've just read this morning that a guy called Saif Gaddafi is standing as the new ruler of Libya. He is, of course, Colonel Gaddafi's son. But on the plane, I had to eat a part of my passport because, the announcement was, ladies and gentlemen, we have now crossed the border into the great socialist state of Libya. We are over the sea of death. We will shortly be landing in Tripoli. Anybody who has any evidence of having collaborated with the Western Satans or Israel will be immediately apprehended on arrival.
Oh, so you had an Israeli stamp.
Israeli stamp in my passport.
You ate the page.
I had to go into the loo, right? I had to rip the page out of my passport, go in the loo, and chew it up. And then I was so paranoid, I thought, I'm not going to throw this down the loo. They could even search through it, you know what I mean, and try and, you know, find evidence against me or something. So I just had to chew it and chew it and chew it and swallow it, which is what I did. And
criminal.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And
You could have gone to jail for that.
Well, they couldn't prove it, could they?
Because you can't. Well, no, back here, because you can't deface Her Britannic Majesty's passport. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to her.
Well, I'd rather face justice in Britain than be locked up in a jail in Tripoli, which is not very pleasant, I would imagine. But anyway, the rest is history. I got in there 36 hours later. The Americans did bomb it. Bang. Smashed up everywhere. Bombed the hotel I was in. You know, it's a very exciting, but quite stressful job of all the jobs we've done. One night, by the way, the only place you could get a drink in Tripoli was at the British ambassador's residence. The British embassy had closed down, but there was one guy left, one official at the who was living in the ambassador's residence, which was a magnificent building, as you can imagine. You know,
they always are, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Built in colonial times, swimming pool, all that kind of stuff, you know. So if we could find a taxi driver, we went over to the embassy and got absolutely bladderated on the official
great... They've always got a stuffed booze cabinet. These diplomats, isn't it?
Absolutely. We could get over there, you know, whenever we could. That was about every third or fourth night. And get absolutely blasted on gin and tonics. He seemed to have like a room full of gin, you know what I mean? And we just got...
What's his address?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then, because it's lawless in Tripoli, more or less, and it was then because it was after the first bombing, this guy, the one diplomat, would drive us back to our hotel in the official ambassador's car, a white Jaguar, right? And we'd have the windows open and we'd be shouting and singing out the back, you know, Gaddafi is a tosser. Gaddafi. Yeah.
Off with his head.
Yeah, exactly. And all that kind of stuff. But anyway, there we go. They were in past days. Right, just before we go, Miss Jones, why is Bob Geldof ranting and raving again? He's been a bit of a ranter and raver for the last sort of 30, 40 years. I didn't realise, because I read that he's fallen out with his local water company over sewage disposals. I didn't realise he's 70. Bob Geldof, 70.
He got old. They all get old.
Yeah.
I think we're a bit bored of him now, aren't we? I mean, all he does is moan. Yeah. I know he's had a hard life in lots of ways and lots of tragedy in his life, and so on.
Yeah.
But he does tend to rail against these things. And sometimes I think he's a bit of a failed politician.
Mm. Yeah, maybe.
You know, he's a bit cross with the way he's spent his life because he hasn't been that effective, has he, really? I mean, we know the truth about Live Aid and everything else now and how most of the money was misappropriated and misdirected and so on.
Sadly,
I don't think anyone cares, frankly.
No, I don't either, to be honest. And I do think he liked being a saint. I met him a couple of times, you know, during the aftermath of Live Aid, Ethiopia and all that, and he had a very saintly way about him, you know what I mean?
He also made a lot of money as a result of his reputation soaring through the roof on a global scale because of Live Aid.
He
did very nicely, thank you. I'm not saying that he took funds for himself, but he had a television company at the time, which he managed to sell for multi-millions.
I agree.
So he's done all right, Jack.
I think he's very smart. He cashed in on his amazing popularity, you know, the St. Bob theme and all that kind of stuff, and he did okay. Good luck
to him. It's an ill wind, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Good luck to anybody who does well in life. Right. Okay, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. Thank you to all our millions of listeners, and we'll see you again this time next week. She ended up, fortunately, her dad knew somebody on the council who managed to get her a council flat, right? And but it was
she saw you coming, rich Porky, swinging your wallet.
Well, I wasn't swinging my wallet, but I mean,
swinging something else.
No, Miss Jones, family show,
family
please.
Show.
Let's not get into that. And I actually said, you know, I admire the Scots. They got through to the playoffs now for next year's World Cup, and they've done it on a very small squad of players. You know, for instance, they can't even call on players these days from the English Premier League. And it went on past until, you know, somebody picked it out on a sort of five-second clip and put it out and said, you're an idiot. And I found out then they have got players from the English Premier League, so I've got a bit lambasted for that. The penalty is I'm going to have to appear on the same show in a kilt on St Andrew's Day, which is November the 30th.
And you know what I'm going to ask?
Oh, no, I'm sorry, Miss Jones. I don't reveal secrets like that. No way in the world, you know. I will not even tell you on the day. But anyway,
Tesco's or Armani.
Yeah, absolutely. See, that's a bit harsh, isn't it? You know, I'm the butt of a lot of your jokes, aren't I, Miss Jones? Anyway, listen, we can't...
You sound like Mr. Rigsby.
Yeah, well, I'm a bit... I had to go into the loo, right? I had to rip the page out of my passport, go in the loo and chew it up. And then I was so paranoid, I thought, I'm not going to throw this down the loo. They could even search through it, you know what I mean? And try and, you know, find evidence against me or something. So I just had to chew it and chew it and chew it and swallow it.